Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Chris Scully. Today we'll be hearing from Troy Mayor Patrick Madden as he discusses some current issues being faced in the city.
Then WOOC correspondent Aaron Pednotti talks with New Yorican poet Jesus Papoleto Melendez about an upcoming event in Albany.
And later on, we'll get into the proposed expansion of the bottle bill in the upcoming state budget.
After that interview, we will be discussing tenants' rights in Troy with guest Caroline Nagy.
Finally, we'll hear from two local organizers of the Albany March for Science about an upcoming State of Science panel. Let's start the show off with some headlines.
12 people holding a vigil to seek more financial resources for programs to help the homeless were arrested at the New York State Capitol last Tuesday. The protesters were detained after refusing to leave the Capitol building after it closed for the day. They had planned to hold the vigil for 24 hours. The group consisted of homeless or formerly homeless individuals and advocates pushing for more funding for this issue. The demonstration was meant to draw attention and support before the April 1st budget finalization by Governor Andrew Cuomo for the start of the fiscal new year. The protesters hope to have increased in financial support for rental assistance programs for low-income families and individuals at risk for becoming homeless. In the past, meetings to address the homelessness issue in Albany have been heavily underrepresented by the homeless population of the city itself. Instead, businesses and property owners concerned with their potential customers being asked for money outside of their establishments are often the ones in attendance.
With growing concerns of food quality and diminishing landfill capacity, the Albany Common Council is once again considering allowing the raising of chickens within city limits. Councilman Tom Hoey cited sustainability as the biggest reason for revisiting the chickens in Albany debate for the first time since 2011. Food waste makes up approximately 20% of waste in landfills, but most table scraps can be fed to chickens. Residents would be required to have code enforcement officer inspect the property before they could purchase the birds. In addition, 800 square feet per hen would be required. Roosters would not be allowed, and individuals would not be permitted to slaughter their own hens. Restriction on the distance kept between kept pens and neighboring properties would also be imposed. These heavy restrictions could diminish the effectiveness of allowing chickens within city limits to address food, health, and waste management concerns.
New York State is attempting to place a tax on opioids in order to cover the cost of addiction treatment programs. The new proposal will likely pass the financial burden of the tax onto the customers rather than the drug companies themselves. This comes after the rejection of last year's proposal, which placed a tax on opioids while requiring drug manufacturers to not raise the product cost for consumers. The drug companies sued lawmakers when the tax was imposed, and the federal court ruled in their favor, stating that the tax infringed on federal interstate commerce laws. Opponents of the proposal state that drug companies continue to avoid having to bear responsibility for opioid addiction, while addicts are cast as villains. Governor Cuomo has failed to comment on this issue so far.
Governor Cuomo and state legislators are debating a number of competing proposals regarding New York's bail law for the upcoming state budget. Many are calling for changes to the bail system due to the active discrimination and mistreatment of poor and working class people. According to federal statistics, about 14,000 unconvicted people sit in jail every day, unable to afford the high cost of bail as they await their trials. In many cases, this prevents individuals from having full access to superior legal representation, support, and resources needed for their cases. It also increases the odds of accused individuals losing their jobs due to time away from work, thus making their financial situations increasingly difficult. Of all felony charges in the state, only about 20% actually end in felony convictions.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm at mediasanctuary.org.
And now, let's hear from Troy Mayor Patrick Madden on some current issues in the city as he speaks with media correspondent Corinne Carey.
Mayor Madden, thanks so much for sitting down and speaking with me again. Welcome back to WOOC.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Pleasure to speak to you.
Back in January, you told WAMC, speaking of the proposed Sanctuary City resolution, that you've been working with Corporation Counsel and the police chief to review current case law that addresses the issue to make sure that we're not doing anything as a city if we move in that direction that impairs our ability to get federal resources or, you know, endangers public safety or interferes with our ability to prosecute crimes. Has there been anything that's been concluded from that review?
Not yet. We're actually going to meet on that this week. But there's a number of issues relative to so-called sanctuary city status that could impact us in different ways. And we want to reach out and research each one of those issues.
So the review with Corporation Counsel and the police chief is still ongoing?
It's ongoing, yep.
Do you have any idea when that'll be concluded and what you plan to do with that? Will it inform your decision, or do you plan on releasing a report, making those findings available?
I can't say at this time. I think it'll lead us where it leads us. I can't predict where that is or how long that will take. But we've been having some good conversations about it.
And conversations also with community members? Is that something you're still engaging in?
Frankly, I've asked the city council since they proposed the resolution to go out and have meetings with the community. And they have had some meetings with the community. I'd still like to see more.
Yeah, I remember the last time we spoke, you basically said people shouldn't be going out and speaking to their own communities. They should be reaching out to communities that may not agree with them and have broader discussions. Are you satisfied with what the city council's been doing to reach out, to reach deeply into communities?
Well, I think, frankly, I'd like to see a little bit more. And I think it's important on any issue that might be contentious that we try to learn how to speak to each other, that we debunk the myths on both sides, and that we have a fair and open exchange. Obviously, some people aren't interested in that. They have their particular bent on things, and they don't want to be dissuaded by facts. But I think it's important that we try to reach those who are open to conversation around issues like this. So I think it's an important, not just for sanctuary city status, but we're doing the same thing with the Mount Ida Dam. There are people who are very passionate about it. And people on both sides of the issue. And we're trying to bring them together through a series of meetings and see if we can develop some consensus around the issue, get to know each other's position.
The last time we spoke also, I asked you about parking. It was a big issue for people. And I remember you talking about wanting to come up with a plan for parking in the city that really took into consideration a forward-looking agenda to a time when we might not be as reliant on cars. Mm-hmm. And I know that your office just released an update on parking. And I think, you know, maybe I'll let you explain it, but it looks like those garbage-shrouded parking meters
not,
are going to...
Not garbage-shrouded, garbage-bag-shrouded.
Garbage-bag-shrouded right. Parking meters are going to be a thing of the past by tomorrow?
Tomorrow, we're going to unveil the parking meters. We had gone through and relocated some of the meters to places where it made more sense to have them. And then each of the meters was upgraded electronically. I don't know off the top of my head how old those meters are, but a lot has changed technologically since they were installed. And we were seeing more and more breakdowns with them. So it did take some time to go through. The other thing we needed to do was straighten out the signage. We didn't want to start enforcing parking restrictions with conflicting signs all around the city. So we had to go around and find out what ones we needed to take down. And then where we installed meters, we needed to install new signs alerting people to the fact that this block is now metered parking. So they will be unveiled tomorrow. Thank you for bringing that up. It helps us get the word out to people. Parking I presume we're focused on downtown Troy at this point.
But yeah, I think a lot of people have concerns, particularly residents and
sure.
business owners, about their own ability to park. And
yeah.
So the question has come up a number of times about resident permit parking.
Yeah, the thing is, any time you reside or have a business in a dense urban environment, there are pluses and minuses to that. Same thing if you live or work in the suburbs, there are pluses and minuses to that. Every city has challenges with parking just because of the density of people in a confined geographic area. And we all seem to be bringing these 3,500-pound cars along with us wherever we go in the downtown. Obviously, it's not going to work if everybody wants to have a spot right outside their door. So even in the downtown, there are a number of competing interests. Residents would love to park close to their homes. Businesses who depend upon turnover, like a restaurant or a bookstore or a lunch shop, they need parking for their employees. But they also need parking that turns over so that they can have a customer base can be sufficient to support them. And if the city has a reputation of spots never turning over and people can't stop and get their business done, then they're going to take their business elsewhere, where and all of our local merchants are going to close up. So we're trying to balance a number of competing interests. And as I indicated, some parties have competing interests themselves. So the business owner wants a place for his employees to park and a place for his or her patrons to be able to park as well. We're trying to balance all of that. In addition, creating new parking is exceedingly expensive. So if we're looking at a parking facility, you're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 per unit. If you're looking at a surface lot, you know, that really doesn't lend itself to an urban environment, not the urban environment we want to create. And it's also an opportunity cost because you're not developing that land for another use. So there are a lot of competing views in the mix. At the same time, we're looking at younger people moving away from using automobiles the way my generation did. And we don't want to tie up a lot of resources for 30, 40 years when we think the landscape is changing. Right now we're going through and we've been a little bit smarter in where we put meters so that the metered areas are the areas where we're trying to encourage turnover so that businesses can survive. We got a little smarter on where we're placing the meters. We're also looking at our city-owned lots and trying to come up with a plan for visitor parking. We're also looking at the next stage of meters, which will allow people to pay on their phone. And ideally, at some point, a phone app could be used to identify where there's an available spot on a particular street. So we're moving in that direction. We're trying to create efficiencies with the spots that we do have, trying to create turnover in the areas where we need turnover. Parking is a work in progress in this city and every city. But I would never not go to Boston because parking is difficult, or, you know, not go to London, downtown London, because it's hard to park there. You make accommodations to live or work in those areas.
A related question came up, and that is the prevalence, the working order of CCTV cameras in downtown Troy. The idea was, you know, I wouldn't feel so bad parking so far away from where I have to live or work if I knew that security, I felt safe doing so, mm-hmm. but also if the CCTV cameras around the city were operational. Frankly, I didn't know how many CCTV cameras were even downtown. And mm-hmm. so what do you know about this? Are they operational? Do we have them?
Well, they are by and large operational. They do cut in and out because the frequency that we're on conflicts with another commercial user in the downtown area. And so we need to solve that problem. They're also aging. They're approaching 10 years old now. And like any piece of equipment, you're going to have more problems as a piece of equipment ages. So they do cut in and out. They're probably less useful for making somebody feel safe because it's not as though we have police officers sitting in the station watching all the monitors. The monitors are in the police station and they might glance up as they're doing other work, but mostly they're for solving crimes if a crime occurs. Probably more important for the feeling of public safety is getting more people out on the streets so that you're not walking down a street feeling like you're the only one on the street. You may feel unsafe under those circumstances, but if there's 30 or 40 other people walking on the street, you don't feel as unsafe regardless of the time of day. Also, we're looking at our street lights and our trees. We have a canopy of trees that in some instances is interfering with the light that the street lights throw. So the streets are unnecessarily dark. So we're going through, we're looking at that, having some tree people help us with those sorts of issues so that we don't damage the trees, yet we maximize the amount of light that's hitting on the ground. So getting people out on the street, creating light, creating more patrols downtown, those are the things that are going to lend themselves to a safer environment, not so much cameras.
City Council President Mantello recently voted against a resolution to award a $200,000 contract to River Street Planning to overhaul the city's zoning ordinance. It passed 4-2. Half the funds for the contract come from the Troy Redevelopment Foundation, a group of local large nonprofits, which Mantello said would be better spent fixing the potholes and city surveillance cameras, like we just talked about. How do you respond to that?
Well, we have the funding for the cameras, so that's in place. She is aware of that. But the money that comes from the Troy Redevelopment Foundation, at least this portion of the money, is directed by the Troy Redevelopment Foundation. So they want to see some things that get done in the city. It's important to them that we have a good, solid zoning plan. It impacts the neighborhoods surrounding the universities. And so they've put their money toward that. I can't redirect that money. This is a priority of theirs. They're paying for it. Great. Let's get it done. Nobody else is going to come along and pay for it for us.
No word on the potholes, though.
Well, potholes are, you know, welcome to the Northeast. We have crazy weather that I don't remember it being like this when I was a kid. And when I say that, I mean the freeze-thaw cycles are much more extreme. We would get snow and it would stay for the winter. Now we have 5-degree days followed by 45-degree days. So that constant thawing and refreezing causes water to seep into cracks or imperfections in the road. And when it freezes, it expands and cracks the surface. During the winter months, we do not have access to hot blacktop. So anything we put in there to plug it during the winter is what we call cold patch. And it stays until the next snowstorm or the next time there's a freeze-thaw cycle, and then it pops out again. The good news is the blacktop plants are now open as of a day or two ago, and so we're starting to get hot blacktop that we can put in, and it's a more permanent fix. But this is pretty typical for this time of year. Potholes become an issue in March. By June, we're not talking about them anymore. By August, we can't even spell pothole. And then again, next March, all of a sudden, it's a crisis again. It's part of the cycle of living in the Northeast. Let me just, if I could, say one more thing. We do have, on our website, we do have a place to report potholes. And since the beginning of the year, we've had a good number of people utilize that service, and they've been pleased that we've been able to respond. We like to think that we, you know, we will see the potholes, but there's sometimes we don't go down a street for a week or two. So it's good for residents to let us know when there's a pothole. We'll come along and fill it, even if it's cold patch. Get something in there until the blacktop plants open.
Well, sticking with the environment for a minute, there have been a number of reports recently about how China is no longer accepting our recycling. And I think a lot of people are worried when we actually put our stuff out to be recycled, is it being recycled? And how close and how soon can we get to zero waste so we don't have to worry so much about that here in Troy? What are your thoughts about recycling? Well, is it a knowable thing?
You know, we'll get to zero waste when people stop producing waste. And it's very hard to do. That's not a judgment statement. It's very hard to do in this economy because we've come to demand that things be packaged in a certain way when they're sold to us, and tamper-proof and things of that nature. That adds a lot of packaging that gets discarded. Our recycling is currently being recycled, but I am nervous about the future of the markets. I do think that part of this problem was that we, 10 or 12 years ago, tried to make recycling easier. So we instituted single-stream recycling, and the recycling plants would be able to sift it and sort it. Their ability to do that is not perfect. So the recycling streams that were ending up in China had contamination rates that became unacceptable. We've got to go back to the early days of recycling where we wash out the cans and bottles, where we separate the paper from the cans and bottles, because a single stream just was not pure enough for the markets. Additionally, markets will develop, but I do think we need, not just here in Troy, but across the country, we need to get better at separating the various types of recycling materials so that more easily can create a market for those used materials.
It's a good thing I never got used to that single source recycling. I wipe out and wash out everything.
I have two bins and I still separate everything.
Yep, we do too.
And that was Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Corinne Carey speaking with the mayor of Troy in regards to parking, potholes, recycling, sanctuary city debate, and other issues.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. In our next segment, WOOC correspondent Aaron Pedinati talks to New Yorican poet Jesus Papaleto Melendez about an upcoming Albany event honoring his friend and fellow poet Pedro Pietri.
I'm Aaron Pednati, and today I'm interviewing Jesus Papaleto Melendez, who goes by Papo, about an upcoming event in Albany that is being organized and hosted by Capital District Latinos in honor of the New Yorican poet Pedro Pietri. Papo, who is himself a founding member of the New Yorican poetry movement, will be a keynote speaker at the event. Papo, thanks for joining us. It's good to have you back on the show. To start out, can you tell us about the New Yorican poetry movement? When did it get started, and what was it all about?
Well, the New Yorican Poets Movement started late 60s, early 70s. And it was a group of poets who didn't know each other really personally, but they were working in their own vacuum, in their own spaces. You know, me in El Barrio and then in the Bronx, Pedro Pietri on the west side, Miguel Agarin on the lower east side. You know, they were scattered. We didn't really know each other. But you know how the village is, the East Village and the West Village, Greenwich Village, we gravitated to that area because it still had the beat aura going on. And the New Yorican Poets Movement is actually a post-beat movement. So we just got to know each other slowly but surely. We're reading at different venues. There was a political movement going on. Poets were in demand to express the needs and the reality of our people. That's really what the New Yorican Poets movement is about, giving voice to our people's reality at that time. You know, they were talking about the late 60s, early 70s. And so the writers are writing, but not coalescing, I would say. Miguel Agarin, who is the founder of the New Yorican Poets Cafe, the cafe itself, which is an institution that, you know, keeps us all together as the New Yorican Poets Movement. But the cafe is a cafe, a cultural, you know, showplace. You know, he loaned his apartment on 6th Street, and there we between A and B, and we all hung out just like a salon kind of reading situation, and we began to read our poems to one another. And that's basically how the New Yorican Poets Movement began, and how it extended into the cafe when Miguel Angarín and Miguel Piñero, the author of the play Short Eyes, were able to purchase the bar on 6th Street.
And the name itself, New Yorican, sounds like it gestures towards an idea of cultural hybridity. There's New York and there's Puerto Rico together in that name. So can you comment on that a little?
Oh, yeah, that's essential to the whole concept of New Yorkianism. It began as a derogatory term, to be, you know, quite blunt about it, coming from the islanders, mainline islanders in Puerto Rico, talking about the Puerto Ricans who had left the island and came to New York or to the United States, and those of us who were in New York, and we would go visit Puerto Rico with our broken Spanish and our English dominance, were referred to as New Yorkians, or, you know, Neo-Ricans. And so that whole, you know, how should I say, cultivated itself into the word New Yorkian. We embraced it. It was a label to embrace. Rather, it was although it initiatedly it was derogatory, it was not like the kind of arithmetic you need to make the N letter a positive.
So in a sense, yeah, like an example of cultural reappropriation, a term of abuse that's taken up as a badge of pride.
Yeah. And it, you know, the things that have come out of the movement, you know, spoken word, say, a lot of hip hop, rap and so forth, you know, it's really permeated a lot of the culture. It's a subculture that's permeated the main culture, you know, oblivious to it, I would say.
So can you tell us about the life and work of Pedro Pietri, in whose honor the event in Albany is being held?
Pedro was a great poet. Passed away in March of 2004. Tragically, he was suffering from cancer. He was in Mexico, and he was trying to get back to New York City. So he died in transit, in flight. That being said, his classic book, Puerto Rican Obituary, which came out in 1975, has such great poems that talk about the plight and the struggle of the Puerto Rican reality here in New York and in the island. Now, Pedro's technique of poetry was comedy and irony, and so his poems are hilarious in their poignant view of what was going on, and highly political and extremely quotable. So he's the prime New Yorican poet, I must say, along with Jorge Brandon and Coco que Habla. But Jorge Brandon's from the island. Pedro, too, but Pedro is a quintessential New Yorican, having arrived in New York as a little boy. So he's to be read. It surprises me when people don't know about him. But he was my good friend. We hung out for about 35 years together. I was with him in Mexico with his brother when we were trying to deal with his cancer. And we were all on the plane together when he surreally passed away.
You were present on the plane when he passed away?
Oh, yes, yes. There's a recording that I did for StoryCorps, and if people go there and you know, type in Pedro's name, it comes up, and it's just 3 minutes of a longer piece where I actually talk about the moment when Pedro passes away in flight. He was very sick, and we were in Mexico for about the last 43 days of his life for a special cancer treatment center, which is a very good cancer treatment center, except Pedro was, you know, far gone by that time. And his brother and I, you know, took him to the center, and we were with him, and we tried to just make him live longer, but he got worse, and we decided to bring him back home so that he could, you know, be with his family rather than pass away in Mexico. But we had to rent an airplane, like an air ambulance, and we were able to fly back to New York. But Pedro passed away on the second leg of the trip, which was from El Paso, Texas, to St. Louis.
So now I want to ask you about the upcoming event. Who will be presenting at it, and what will it involve?
Well, my participation is to have a presentation in the evening to the student body. I'm not certain exactly where, but the auditorium or something. And what we're planning is like an interview, as we're having here, about Pedro, and read some of his works and talk about him and so forth. And then I'll get into a thing of reading some other works and stuff like that. It'll be about an hour and a half presentation.
And my last question,
yes.
My last question is, if people want to attend the event, when and where is it being held?
The event is on Friday, April 5th, at the center itself, the Community Engagement Center, 160 Central Avenue.
Center, 160 Central Avenue, Albany.
Yes, I'm not familiar with Albany too much. I thank you, Alan, for this interview.
My pleasure. Thanks, Papo. And best of luck with your event.
Thank you very much.
After my interview with Papo, I found the StoryCorps piece in which he describes being present for Pedro's final moments on a flight returning to New York from Mexico. Here it is.
We took off, and as we were ascending, before we had leveled off, our level off point was 45,000 feet. So before we had leveled off, Pedro began leaving us. The beauty about it is that I believe that there's something after life. You could see it in Pedro. Pedro's eyes were open when he was leaving. And when he was leaving, you could see him like no longer paying attention to us, although we were yelling and screaming and telling him to stay in this little plane, you know. His eyes, although open and looking at me, were focused somewhere else deep inside his head. That's who he was paying attention to, That's where he was going. He went somewhere. You could see it, and there was no pain. There's a quiet dignity in that. And, you know, hey, you know, I hated to see my friend go. I love my friend very much. I miss him as all hell. But that was beautiful. That was profound. I had no idea that Pedro and I becoming friends would one day lead to me holding his hand in his final moment and seeing him leave. Like my son said, this is the day you cats had never planned for. And he was right. But it was beautiful. It was a gift that he gave to me in his leaving. And although he was a profound poet, a great person, a great pain in the ass, his leaving like that just shows you that life is indeed a mystery and that this bullshit on earth is not all there is to life. That the spirit matter is what matters more than the human matter.
And that was Jesus Papaleto Melendez speaking with Aaron Pednotti of WOC.
Now let's move on to tenant rights in Troy. We are joined today by Caroline Nagy from Troy DSA. Caroline has a broad background, including a law degree, and is active on many issues. Notably, Caroline has been outspoken in support of making Troy a sanctuary city. Caroline will be giving a presentation and workshop on tenants' rights at the Oakwood Community Center on Wednesday from 6 to 7:30 p.m., sponsored by the Democratic Socialists of America. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Welcome, Caroline.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's get that mic maybe a little bit. There we go. Okay. You know, usually when we do these interviews, we have a whole sheet of questions to rely on and fall back on. And we just figured since we've both been tenants and I've worked as a property manager that we should just kind of throw that out the window and see where this whole thing leads. So why don't we start with, though, what is motivating the Democratic Socialists of America to sponsor this event?
Sure. Thanks. So basically what we've seen here in Troy is that housing issues are a huge problem for many people who live here. The majority of people who live in Troy are renters, and yet there are actually not very many resources for renters or a lot of laws to protect them like you might have in larger cities in New York State. And so we decided that maybe the first step would be to host a Know Your Rights event, which we're doing on Wednesday of this week at Oakwood Community Center. And the reason that we decided to do that was to basically just see who all is out there in Troy who's interested in learning more about tenants' rights and who's interested in working to improve conditions. What we've seen in Troy is a large number of evictions. If you ever go to Troy Court on Thursday morning, there's a big line of people. And, you know, the evictions happen pretty quickly. It's like people are in front of the judge for maybe 30 seconds, and then that's it. They're out of their home. In addition to that, just walking around some neighborhoods, you can see that we have a lot of buildings where renters live that are in really poor condition. So housing conditions and getting landlords to appropriately take care of their rental properties is a huge issue. And this also has to do a lot with having a large number of out-of-town landlords who don't particularly care necessarily how, you know, what condition their buildings are in. They don't shovel, they don't deal with trash, they don't make repairs. And obviously this impacts not only their tenants, but also their neighbors and everyone who lives here and has to deal with that. We've been walking around canvassing and talking to people on the street about this event. And once you say something about, oh yeah, we're concerned about out-of-town landlords, everyone, you know, has a story to tell. Everyone has a property. I mean, I live here. I have a property, you know, that I live by that, you know, I see the trash, I see the snow, everything, you know, and it's really frustrating. And then the final issue is, in some parts of Troy, we're starting to see, you know, a renewed interest in people moving here and living here, and that's driving up rents quite a bit in some parts. In downtown Troy, you can see rents that wouldn't be too out of place in Brooklyn, New York. So these are all, you know, a number of issues, and I think it's going to become an increasing concern. So we really need to get together, I think, as a community and address how we want to deal with the issues here. So in addition to having a guest from United Tenants of Albany come and give a presentation, a sort of a know your rights presentation, here are your rights, what to do if your landlord won't make repairs, what to do if you fall behind on your rent and you need a little help. But then also just things, basic tips about how to get your deposit back. And then additionally, we're going to have a guest from the Housing Justice for All campaign, which is working across New York State to make some legal changes and reforms to improve tenant protections. And that includes things like having more protections, more automatic right to lease renewal if you haven't, you know, done anything wrong, and a number of other reforms, which I can go into. But That's why we're doing this. That's why we've been out canvassing. That's our interest in this issue. I think it's a really important one. And I mean, not just in Troy, throughout the country. Ultimately, housing is a human right. And the way we treat it, especially in New York, is that it's, you know, it's an investment vehicle first. And so we think we really need to sort of put some more weight on the scales and have more protections for tenants.
I got a couple questions percolating in my head. One of them, it's from the beginning of your description when we were talking about a housing court, basically, and people just getting tossed out on their ear after a very quick hearing. My own experience, and granted this was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which may have a different flavor to it, but a lot of times tenants were given a longer leash to allow for them to recover and make up back rent and that type of thing rather than just getting forced out. And that was a recognition by the municipality that you're just creating more problems if you create an entire family or multiple families that are homeless. So I guess I'm wondering whether your description is wholly accurate in terms of people just getting tossed out on their ears or whether there's more of a process for people.
Well, it all depends, really, I think, on whether your landlord wants you out or not, or whether they're willing to make some kind of arrangement. The other issue is one of an imbalance of power. Mm-hmm. Very few tenants can afford to get an attorney. And Troy doesn't really have any dedicated legal services specifically for people in Troy. The Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York does represent a small number of tenants who have eviction cases, but it's a real drop in the bucket compared to the number of people. So, you know, in the situation you're talking about in Cambridge, there's wiggle room. There's, you know, room to negotiate. A lot of this happens because you have better protections. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're just one person who without a knowledge of the law and you go to court and let's say you fell behind on your rent, there's really not a lot of protections out there for you right now. And without having an attorney to represent you in court, you're not really going to be able, you're not even going to know if you have any grounds to try and negotiate on. Getting legal representation, you know, really makes a huge difference because they can say, wait a second, you know, did your landlord give you the right notices? Is this by the book? You know, what about this? What about that? Let me talk to their lawyer. Let's see if we can make a deal. But that doesn't happen for most people. Mm-hmm. So right now it seems like, yeah, there's just not a lot out there to help.
So I've rented most of my life in Troy. I've been here for about 14 years or so, but I'm now happily a homeowner in Lansingburg. For the entirety of the time that I've lived here, there's been this looming specter of gentrification and displacement. There's a ton of municipal resources being put into the downtown through the Business Improvement District. And things have become much cleaner, much nicer, a lot of investment, a lot of capital flowing into downtown. And with that has had a number of very large housing complexes. And what I noticed was that the vast majority of those complexes cater to the top 5%-ish of the possible renters in Troy.
And they're going up by, you know, hundreds of units at a time. Like the News, which used to be the old Troy Record building. And what was explained to me from someone that lived in Brooklyn was that as these large housing structures go up and they produce lots and lots of housing, but it's only to the top 5% of the market, that what that does is two things. One, it brings richer people into the city to rent those luxury condo style spaces, but also it allows for renter or landlords in the surrounding area to be able to argue that their commensurate rent for their space has gone up because the median value for the block or the area has gone up. And so people seem to not want to displace Trojans. People also want to have really nice stuff and allow for capital to inflow. And it always seemed to me that rent control is so obviously the silver bullet. So am I right or am I wrong? And either way, how would we go about trying to establish some type of rent control?
Well, there's a lot there. So I think, so I lived in New York City for 10 years before I moved to Troy. And I was a renter and a housing activist there. And actually now in Troy, I'm also a homeowner. And I think when it comes to displacement and gentrification, you know, we're in a pretty different situation than Brooklyn in that I think right now Troy has, you know, Troy has room for a lot more people. We have a lot of, Troy has good, you know, a lot of older buildings, a lot of vacant and abandoned buildings. This is a city, you know, that once had a much bigger population than it does today. So I think that's good news because there's room to attract new people. There's room to attract people, you know, from the region, more immigrants, which is, you know, something I would like to see here, especially to get some better Mexican food, to be very shallow for a second. But I think, you know, when you start getting a lot of new development, you know, other property owners, the dollar signs, you know, start to glimmer in their eye. And so they start to think, well, if this brand new luxury construction with like granite, you know, counters and whirlpool tubs or whatever can get, you know, $2,000 a month for a one bedroom, maybe I should try. And I mean, I think, you know, first of all, you have to have enough people who want that. And so that's going to be an issue here in Troy with all these new buildings coming up. I actually think there's going to be a lot of competition among them to try and attract the type of people who, you know, have the means and desire to spend that much on rent up here, when you can, you know, get lesser prices elsewhere. But with the universal right to counsel, the Housing Justice for All bill, one of the parts of it is to actually allow different municipalities to opt into having rent control. Or actually, I shouldn't say it's not rent control, it's rent stabilization, which is basing your current rents, kind of using that and then giving yourself a certain percentage increase every year, which is set by a local board. Passing this bill doesn't mean that Troy would get rent stabilization, because it just means that Troy could opt into it. So if we pass this bill, which is, you know, being considered in the legislature right now, then, you know, we'll have to have a conversation here in Troy about, you know, what do we want? How much do we want to protect people? Is it in our interest to have tenants be able to stay in place even as rents go up around them? I say yes. Because this is, you know, I mean, we want to have diversity here. We want to have people from different incomes. We want to have racial diversity. And so one way to do that is to have protections for tenants. Another is actually what you just mentioned, having home ownership and giving means for lower income people to become homeowners is a really great way for them to then, you know, have stable housing, because when you're a homeowner, your housing costs, at least your mortgage, you know, taxes, it's something stable and predictable. And so that's a way to help keep people stay in place. And there are actually a lot of good resources for homeowners that you can access through TRIP, unlike renters, where there is not a lot right now.
So we're just about out of time. It's interesting that you brought that up, because I was going to say that maybe one of the solutions is to have it like TRIP is optional, but if there's a mandatory landlords, responsibilities, that might do a little bit. But thank you for joining us. And I, just to reiterate, you're going to be presenting at the Oakwood
Community Center.
Community Center on Wednesday from 6:30 to no 6 to 7:30.
Yeah.
And I certainly will try and attend. So, thank you for joining us.
Looking forward to having you. Thank you so much for having me today.
Okay, and that was Caroline Nagy, as we just said. For those of you just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And now let's get the rundown on the meeting surrounding the budget proposals for the bottle bill that took place on Monday at the state capitol.
My name is Liz Moran. I'm the Environmental Policy Director for NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. We are all gathered today to show broad support for expansion of New York State's bottle deposit law, the most effective recycling and litter reduction policy we have here in New York State. I want to thank Assemblyman Engelbreit, and I believe Assemblywoman Fahey will be joining us, for carrying strong legislation that would expand the bottle deposit law to include non-carbonated beverages, wine, liquor, and cider containers. We also want to thank the governor for introducing legislation in his executive budget proposal. This has put us off to a great start. We are all gathered to urge for this to be done in New York State's budget process. An unusual tactic. I actually want to begin with a question for reporters rather than questions for us. Before me, I have two different containers, and I wanted to see if anyone could give a guess as to which one has a deposit and which one does not. Bottles have a lot in common, the most important thing being they're both made out of plastic. And we have a plastic pollution crisis in this country and around the globe. 8 million tons of plastic end up in our waterways every single year. New York State needs to do its part to stop this crisis, and the bottle deposit law is a critical way to do that. The bottle deposit law in New York State has reduced litter by 70% in its time. There was a 65% redemption rate just in 2017, totaling about 5.1 billion containers. It's time for an expansion. So now I'm going to turn it over to Assemblyman Engelbreit to address his legislation.
In 1982, we began a journey. We initiated what in 1983, when implementation took place, was a landmark nickel deposit on certain containers. We knew we had a journey to make, that other steps would have to be taken. Unfortunately, with the exception of the water containers, which was 10 years ago, we haven't taken other steps. We need to reduce the volume of containers that are going into the landfills and into our streets and into our yards and vacant lots. We need to find a way to support through uniform standards for content of bottles, a stronger market for recyclables. We need to clean up our waterways. I come from Long Island. We have beaches covered with plastic and glass bottles. And we need to take additional steps in our journey toward reducing our overall costs and extending the life of our landfills and reducing the implications of greenhouse gas emissions. We can do this. This is the time to do it. And I applaud my advocate friends from the environmental organizations of the state. This isn't just a time that is due, it is a time that is overdue. And the costs of not doing this exceed by far the costs of doing it. My bill includes not just a wider variety of beverages, including sugared water, but it also includes wine and liquor bottles and cider. So we believe that there can be a market for these containers. We do not believe that the place for them is in our streets and in our environment.
And Pat Fahey,
and to join the chair, Mr. Engelbreit, in support of a bottle bill. Let's face it, we've had 40 years of success, right? But that success now has been stymied, if you will, by the growth of countless more plastic bottles and the craft beverage industry with glass and other bottles. So while this was successful, this is one time we really need to repeat that success and tackle this by expanding the bottle bill. It is well overdue for expansion.
My name is Liz Moran. Nations are releasing a support letter for the expansion to be included in the final budget. I'm joined today by some of those colleagues. This letter has over 50 organizations and businesses supporting an expansion. I'll begin by introducing my colleague Kate Carrera at Environmental Advocates of New York.
Thank you so much for being here, and I think the Assembly members Engelbreit and Fahey so much for joining us and our advocates here today. This is a really important issue. New York's bottle bill is one of the most effective environmental common sense policies that we've seen in terms of showing its real benefits to the environment, keeping the environment in clean and reducing litter pollution. With solid waste crises and recycling crises on the minds of New Yorkers at this point in time, it's critical that we address this issue now. The fact is the bottle deposit program increases recycling rates and effectively redirects solid waste streams. But it is important when we're doing this now that we're thoughtful and then we include glass waste, which is what Assembly Member Engelbreit's bill does. Glass contaminates the waste stream, it breaks when during pickup, and it impedes the recycling process for local recycling programs. So it's really critical that that component gets that as part of this reform.
Pat McClellan of the New York League of Conservation Voters is next.
We support an expansion of the bottle bill because recycling is in crisis in New York and around the world. And that's partly, as Assemblymember Fahey pointed out, because China has mostly stopped accepting recycled goods from the United States. But it's also because of longer-standing structural issues in the recycling market. Our rates of contamination are too high. The rules across jurisdictions are inconsistent in terms of what can and can't be recycled. And moving forward with an expansion of the bottle bill really gets at the root causes of a lot of what's wrong with the way that we do recycling now. Expanding the bottle bill to cover more container types and especially to cover more glass containers, especially wine and liquor, will really go a long way towards boosting the state's recycling rate.
We didn't have some questions for Assemblymember Engelbreit. End up with Liz Moran again.
And I think last time we spoke, you mentioned that you would prefer to do this after the budget just because of some of the complexities that are involved. What changed your mind, and why do you think this is so important to get done in the budget this year?
I am interested in getting this done as soon as possible. We're here this week. We're doing a budget. The governor believes that this is a topic that we should take up in the budget. We have a stronger version in the Assembly bill. If the governor is willing to talk about that this week, we would welcome that conversation, and the sooner we can do this, the better. Don't have intimate knowledge of where the negotiations are. Usually everything waits until the last 15 minutes in the budget process. This is only Monday.
Some of the municipalities say that they want to keep some of these items in the waste stream in order to increase the revenue they receive. How do you respond to that concern?
Well, we need to expand the scope of what they work with to bolster the markets. We need to standardize the post-consumer recycling content of beverage containers generally to make their markets work better. So I believe that this initiative that the Assembly has put forward would help and not hinder.
So Liz, at this point, what do you think is going to happen with the expansion of the bottle bill?
We have strong faith that this will get done. The governor included in his executive budget proposal, which was extremely exciting. The Assembly has great legislation. We want the Senate to come to the table. We think that this can get done. It's really important that we address the recycling crisis and reduce plastic pollution.
And what can residents, listeners do at this point? if they're interested in this?
Call their elected representatives. They should absolutely call their state senator and their assembly members to urge support for this.
And is there information on the NYPERG website about this?
Yes. If you go to NYPERG's website, you can find some of our materials, including our sign-on letter, with 50 organizations supporting an expansion.
Thank you, Liz Moran from NYPERG. This has been Mark Denley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And that was Mark Dunley bringing his statements about from advocates and lawmakers regarding Governor Cuomo's increasing the funding of the state's bottle bill. And that concludes our show for this evening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Chris Scully. Our engineer tonight is Amy Loria. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.